So we're still in scene two as Stifler's been shot. Obviously, some MILF-related prank gone wrong, right?
Well, we've got that. And then actually,
It was the dawn of a new season of You've Got to Check This Out, 10 weeks after the Nerd Youngblood episode. The Babylon 5 television show was a dream given form. Its goal, to tell a five-year story arc and prove the audience would follow along peacefully. It's a major accomplishment, a seminal work, a nostalgic property for nerds, geeks, children of the 80s, and our hosts. This season, we'll dive deep into Babylon 5 Season 1. The year is 2025, and you've got to check this out.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of You Gotta Check This Out. I'm Mike Slater, and my host here today is Dre Alvarez. Dre, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Mike, you have tricked another one of your friends into watching Babylon 5, and I am here for it. So who else do we got with us?
Yeah, this is kind of the idea for this. We want to share with something with not just the listeners, but bring some friends in here to talk about and get some instant reactions to being thrown in the middle of Babylon 5. This is my friend Evan.
Hello.
And I never pronounce your last name. Is it actually Stitely? I realize I've said your last name.
Yeah, that's it. You got it.
Excellent. Evan Stitely, it's good to have you on. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're up to?
Yeah, thank you. So I have a history in music, especially specifically jazz, drumming, a few other instruments as well. And now I'm getting more into like creating comics and illustration and storytelling. That's mostly what I'm into. I'm trying to be as eclectic as possible.
By the way, Mike, so what have we missed if we're talking JMS's vision? What has JMS's vision led us to at this point since we last checked in?
Previously on Babylon 5.
All right, since we last checked in, we were at Signs and Portents, which the big revelation of that episode was it was a secret pilot to Babylon 5. Because Karen watched that episode and did not have to get anything before that. But since then, we've had a huge jump. We've done, what, another 12 episodes? And I was going through the episodes and not a lot of crucial ones to the overall story. It was still just a lot of world building.
I do love some of your TV guides. So episode 16, Mike, you are correct. You've got to read your tagline for episode 16.
Episode 16, Lanier and Garibaldi build a motorcycle.
That happens.
That's pretty much the plot of that episode.
Is They're it at like, least a space motorcycle?
Oh, no, it's
historic. Just a motorcycle. Of course, since it was written in, what, like the early 90s, it's Garibaldi. This is what's the year? This is like 2,000 years in the future. And he's obsessed with, of course, one particular specific motorcycle from the early 90s, right where they're at right now. So the whole episode is just like Lanier and Garibaldi bonding over rebuilding a motorcycle from scratch. And Lanier, up to this point, is the meek Mimbari helper to the ambassador, Delenn, who hasn't really done a whole lot in the background. And all of a sudden, he's building a motorcycle with the security officer. That was the kind of episodes we've been getting since then. We kind of get on a little bit of Babylon Squared. Dre already took us through that, about how Sinclair was going back and forth through time. Not only that, but the two episodes before were a two-part episode where they discover a planet right nearby Babylon 5, Epsilon 3, where there's a whole advanced civilization. And they were feels like, oh, this is setting up to be one of the main things. Like they have this other satellite planet nearby that has a very strategic standpoint with a lot of technology. They do a two-part episode of going down to it. And I think it comes back maybe one more time in the entire series.
It's interesting where I can make the argument that Epsilon 3 is used effectively and it's not like a MacGuffin. But what JMS is really good at is he adheres to the Chekhov's gun principle. We see it in Act 1. We got to see it in Act 3 and vice versa. But it's not always how you think. So it's like, this planet seems important. Is it going to be militarily important? No, not really. We'll use it in other ways. And that's kind of a common theme, but that is an interesting thing to revisit, Mike. And we saw it and we're like, and does it matter? Nope.
Yep. Yep. Well, it doesn't matter. It's like it's all these trap doors that we were talking about that JMS kind of had to initiate between Sinclair. Like, Sinclair was the main protagonist of all those last few storylines, and they kind of had to get shelved in a way because they couldn't develop as much without the same character that, you know, we went through with it from their perspective the first time.
Here's a question I have about that. You've mentioned how there are a lot of episodes that don't necessarily contribute to the larger plot. My question is, do those perspectives highlight any aspects of the characters that deepens like the audience's understanding of them or the interactions? Because I just finished, I don't know if you're familiar with this show, Steven Universe, where it does this thing that's really common with children's cartoons, where the first season is very episodic and then it becomes deeply serialized starting in season two. And that season one partially is the pitch season, this is what it is. It's a kid's show. And it's also partially to really flesh out these characters and get the audience aware of them. So I tend to find plot progression very similar to character progression in terms of my engagement with a story. So I won't necessarily see something as quote filler if it is moving either our understanding of the characters or the characters' relationships with each other. How do you feel that's handled in those?
So yeah, there's episodes? That leads into a couple other things I want to talk about Babylon 5. So we won't go too far into it now because the last few episodes, if you go back, we talked we're just all about world building. And that's how I kind of see it. That's the necessary world building because, you have to see those. You have to get used to the characters. You have to see all the relationships between them. And that's not very easily shown in just one episode or one pilot episode while characters and the writers are still getting their footing on what the whole series is about, which is why that's perfect. What is interesting that I thought with Babylon 5 is that you can really do that or not just because two episodes in the first season were so good at doing that establishment. I was just almost astounded by you could watch these two episodes and you wouldn't get all some of the deep connections, but Signs and Portends and Chrysalis do a wonderful job of I don't know. Have you ever had that friend who says, hey, you got to watch this series, but to start on season three, you don't really have to. That's kind of what we're trying to do with this is we endorse all of Babylon 5 and have loved watching it. But if you want to get the shortened version that'll still get you the entire story, you can just watch these episodes and, hear us tell you about the filler thing and still be in on Babylon 5. And that way you can pick it up later on in season two or three. And actually see where it really gets cooking faster if that's the kind of viewing you want to do.
Yeah, I've got two follow-ups. So first off, yes, the character development.
Two follow-ups?
Two.
You usually have three or four. What's going on, Greg?
Okay, yeah, you're going to be cursed. Okay,
hope you're not holding out on us.
All right, so obviously the character progression is huge. But actually something you said at the start of the show really resonated. It's boring, watching practice is boring because it's, playing at 50 RPM and then upping it to 60 when you're ready. Something that Babylon 5 does is, I want to say, breadcrumb feeding. So we slowly feed you breadcrumbs of things, and then you get these major episodes that kind of pull it together. So that's what's fascinating when we're you don't need to watch all these episodes. You can just watch Chrysalis. Conversely, if you were watching the episodes before Chrysalis, you would be getting small pieces of these advancements. So as an example, and we'll get to that in a thing, Delenn is building this giant magnetics toy, which is, it didn't work as a prop. I'll be curious to hear your thoughts.
Magnetiles.
And, yeah, it does look like magnetiles.
You mean the actual Babylon 5 ship itself, you mean? Or what?
That also looks like magnetiles.
Oh, rough. No, so there's a point where she's building, at the very end where she says it's time. She has been building this, device the entire season.
Oh, right. The thing where she's in the chrysalis.
Yeah,
and
it's a thing that kind of, projects towards the chrysalis. That's been a whole, season-long thing.
I'm curious. Was I supposed to know more about that triangle with the glowing thing in the center? Or is that the beginning of a mystery?
Okay, yes.
Or is that the end?
Yeah,
of
that showed up a couple of times because when she says, recognize this, we have seen a couple flashbacks of Michael O'Hare doing that. But to the same point, it's going, we've been fed it a few times so that when we see it here, we're ready for it. But also, if you just watch this episode and, you know, we're much more, we're 20, 30 years, oh my God, like 30 years in the future when the show came out and have gotten used to all the tropes and stuff so we can catch up quickly. Right. Oh, recognize this. Okay, got it. You don't need to tell me more. When JMS was writing the show, he kind of knew or was told he had to spoon feed a lot more. And he did it effectively, kind of doing that. And I did love the practice metaphor. He's like speeding it too slow. So when he has an episode like this, speaking of this episode, let's get into it. So
well, before you do that, I wasn't quite finished with the topic. I was doing some research on JMS. Here's the quote. Once the series got going, it became apparent that I'd have to learn a whole new way of writing TV that was a lot more like I'd been writing in novel, which were multi-point of view huge stories. It's a kind of writing that's never really been done before for American television, and I had to somewhat invent that style or form of writing as I went in front of millions of viewers. When I was reading him talking about that, like, really? That's the first time it's been going on? So I was looking at other television series, and I could only think of a few in American television that weren't just soap operas. And the first one going back was Soap. I don't know if you guys know about Soap at all.
I'm familiar with Sweat and Soap, but let's not talk about that.
The spoof show on a soap opera?
This was a show in 1977. I remember it because I was born in 77, and it's some of my first memories were like my parents watching the later seasons of this because I went back and watched it later in life. But it's a show that was a comedy. Billy Crystal got his start. He was playing one of the first gay main characters on television at the time. And it was all about just a comedy about trying to spoof soap operas. And their big thing was taking stories and having stories progress into each episode one at a time over seasons. Hill Street Blues was another one where, you know how like now every series since it's like, you don't know whose point of view you're going to go to. You don't know characters you're going to see. Right. There's always like the first spot, like before the opening credits, where they have a little scene with two of the characters and that triggers something in your mind like, oh, that's who we're going to get back into. Like, this is going to be about Jack's tattoos because Jack had this thing at the beginning of Lost. Hill Street Blues started to do that when they did that. They literally called it the Hill Street Blues roll call, where they'd have whoever was going to be the main cops in that episode, they would be just called out and the guy in charge would tell them, all right, you're doing this, go out there and be careful out there. But it's all these things that were kind of leading up to let JMS make these longer form stories.
All right. But I mean, that to that point with when you're talking about the different perspectives, that one of the things he was really aiming for was the Narn and the Zatari, which is where we start.
Yeah.
Those two are going to really pull a lot of the show, and this season is no exception. Evan, you said you watched the first and last episode. The first episode starts with Jakar is 100% the villain. Right. And now in this episode, it's very similar. It's a very similar scene where Londo is basically saying, the Narn are bullying me. I don't like it. But then when Jakar starts getting prodded about it, he's basically saying, you know, a lot of the colonizing stuff that comes up all the time, like British Empire, you're like, yeah, we agreed to that treaty because you forced us to. And is that really fair? And now you're getting upset that we're picking on you. What happened? You picked on us for years. So it's very interesting because it's almost a verbatim scene from the first episode. But now this time, we're getting the extra perspective. And it's still funny because we're seeing Londo as kind of put upon and we're seeing Jakar as kind of a bully, but we're adding to their character. And that's going to be the start of the show. Non-shockingly, though, hey, guess what? That's just the backdrop. Other stuff is going on because immediately, and Mike, you're going to make me laugh with what you put in the script, but I do appreciate your notes. Mike said Stifler's been shot and he is not mistaken.
Stifler's been shot. Could you not see Stifler?
Or Andy Roddick, who now has a great podcast too. So yes, Andy Roddick or Stifler, for those that don't know American Pie.
It's Stifler.
Random guy has been shot. And this is one of the few moments in season one. JMS still did a fair amount of tell don't show. So that cool scene happens. But then Garibaldi comes and tells Commander Sinclair and Ivanova, the number one and two on the station, like, he's like, hey, by the way, did you want this guy's entire backstory as if you were watching this television show to know why it's relevant? That was one of the few parts I thought stood out a little, but it wasn't too horrible.
I think that that could have hit a lot harder if well, it's Garibaldi, right? Who's
Yeah,
the
Garibaldi.
My note for how to remember him was second favorite thing
Oh yeah.
from the first episode. But like if he had been a little more maybe like emotionally affected by it, I could see him kind of rambling a little bit. But he seemed very even and then was just like, yeah, that's that guy's deal, but you know, he's dead
Yeah,
now, so
this was a very different Garibaldi episode. Like he was kind of like the center. It was a detective episode, as a whodunit, and you get. I think that's one of the reasons why we got so many different scenes as we're going to go on in this, because it's Garibaldi going around the station, piecing together all the clues to see, all right, why was this guy mysteriously shot, as he gets deeper and deeper into the web.
Yeah, and I mean, it is worth, we've talked this on the show a couple times. It is worth noting that Jerry Doyle, who played Michael Garibaldi, was not like a trained actor, and he does a fantastic job learning how to be an actor over the course of the show. But season one, there are a lot of points where it's obvious, and that's exactly what you said, Mike, about JMS noting. He's like, hey, when you're writing a novel, you can just say, okay, cut, I'll rewrite it. You're writing a show, it's like, yep, he had to learn to act, but we want him as the actor. And I do think it pays off. There are similar story arcs to this he is going to do in later seasons, where he is a much more accomplished actor at that point, and they pay off way
Yeah, they
better.
didn't put a whole lot on his shoulders up until this point, which is interesting. This is the last episode of season one. They give it most of it over to him. So we're still in scene two, as Stifler's been shot. Obviously, some MILF-related prank gone wrong,
Well,
right?
we've got that, and then actually, this, All right. Anyway, okay. So, scene. We do get to the point now. We do have a lot of jumping around in this episode. So we do see Sinclair and Sakai, who is his. I forget her first name, but she is his, like, gonna be his fiance. She played the teacher in Sidekicks with Chuck Norris, is how I
Ooh,
remember her.
remember that?
But they basically are watching that the president is gonna come, like. He is like going out on the rim doing a goodwill tour, where he's going to say lots of stuff about why aliens are awesome and we need to talk to aliens more.
Thank God nothing bad happens to
Yeah,
him.
it's not, thank God we're not setting up. Now, to be fair, JMS has been doing a really good job all season. So normally this would stand out and you'd be like, what's going to happen to the president? But he has done a very good job. As you remember, episode one is about the election. So that we're like, hey, that
There's a
makes sense.
lot of political stuff going on behind the scenes on Earth. Like, this is where we're going to get into all the secret police in this episode and find out to like what extent Earth has been doing black ops.
We haven't done as much of the like Star Trek versus Babylon 5, but one thing that's worth noting is Star Trek: The Next Generation in the first season, there's this random like, hey, there's this evil group of people in Starfleet, and then it just never comes back, never comes up again. Babylon 5 does a really good job in season one, where there are a couple episodes where they're like, there's this really shady faction of EarthGov. Should we be worried? Spoiler alert, yes, and we're going to find out coming soon. All right. We get back to put upon Londo, and one of my favorite parts about this scene, he's in his quarters talking to Veer, his second, and he's just being like, I'm getting pecked to death by ducks. And he had to, like, JMS had to defend. He's
Think
like,
you mean
that's,
cats?
or cats, because he
You all
thought it
those
was duck.
ducks?
He thought it was
Right,
duck.
I'm just being
You got
cat.
no, you got it, but
What
that's
do
the
those
point. He
things?
made the joke of
Quack,
like,
cats. Yeah, they've got beaks.
And I mean, Peter Jurisic, who plays Londo Mollari, is just, oh my, he's so good. So good. I love him in this show. And so they're doing the nice back and forth. We're seeing Londo as the bumbling buffoon. So that's when we're talking character. Like, this is a pivotal episode for his character, because this is him peak buffoonery. And we're going to see, like, can he be tempted to the dark side? And again, spoiler alert, yes. And you did not watch Signs Importance, but that's where we were introduced to Mr. Morden, who is, clearly the devil. Like, perfect casting, no notes, where he's like, I want someone who is clearly the devil. And if you were paying attention, you'd go like, oh, that guy is the devil.
A whiff of brimstone appears in the room. You rang?
Yeah, it's 100%. So, but he says, hey, I'm going to go talk to Mr. Morden, because in Signs Importance, he said, if you need a favor, come talk. And he also, by the way, it's evidence that you haven't seen that episode, didn't play great, but in that episode, randomly, Londo's like, where will I find you? And Morden has just walked away, but then you hear his voice ominously in the hallway say, "We'll find you," but like, oh, he's not present. Yeah. So it's like, it's just all sorts of, hey, don't mess with this guy. But that's who's Londo. When he says, "I'm going to go talk to Mr. Morden," that is who he is. That is who he is.
He's so shadowy for some reason.
All right. Now, I am definitely curious. I don't think you've met Lanier at this point then. So we're introduced to Delenn and Lanier. Mm-hmm. And Lanier is, again, working on her magnetiles and just says, "Hey, Lanier, did you get the answer from Kosh?"
Yeah.
And yeah, he just goes, "Yes." And I actually am curious. Like, this is always the "you got to check this out" thing where I'm like interested in someone who was not a fan of the show necessarily or watching the first one. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious, like, your reaction to this scene at all, because it's kind of interesting. And I don't know if you've never seen anything else, how it stood
out.
Yeah,
right. I mean, it's like, it's a little bit abstract, right? Because it's like, they're giving these short answers to these questions that are, or like, cause I don't, what exactly was the question that, Delenn asked, Kosh, what was the question?
Did
again?
They even say the question? She just said, "Did you repeat
I think,
as I said it?" And he just said the answer.
Yeah.
Is
right.
Yes.
And then he just said the answer is yes. Right. And now she's doing some kind of transformation that I'm assuming is related to
it was, even after the watching triangle, the whole season up to that point, it was that scene was still confusing to me. You just know there's something mysterious going on with Kosh. There's some relationship with the Minbari, but you're still not sure at this
Kosh
point.
Kosh is like, because Kosh is like a super powerful telepath, ? Is that what
question.
That is?
Yeah.
Kind of gives off that vibe. And also, like, the big head people, they've got big heads and they've got the triangle thing that does some kind of mind thing. So, and also Kosh is talking all about, like, it's been set in motion. Like, I don't know if that goes so far as future vision or if it's just like from reading many minds. Again, like, what even it means to be a telepath in this world to me is still a little, I know that there are humans who can read minds and they can be trained to filter in and out certain thoughts, and there's that whole thing. But I'm curious if aliens have a different relationship with
telepathy and science. Yeah, they
do. Or if it's the same throughout different species.
There is a lot of that. Like, each race kind of does have its own, like, psionic portion of it, or they treat it different. Yeah. Like, the Earth especially. Mm-hmm. We'll get way into this later in the series, but the Psi-Corps are some of is one of the huge behind the scenes shadowy operatives on Earth that's working with, like, the parts of Earth Force that are becoming more fascistic.
And that's an excellent call on the Vorlons, because they're the most advanced. So when you're saying, like, different levels of psychic, there are psychic people, there are people that have visions in this universe, and the Vorlons are pretty, we don't know a lot, but we do, like, good catch to be like, seem psychic, but to what degree? That is a good pickup in kind of seeing where the show is going. We're not going to find out much more this episode.
Yeah, not until the end of season two do you really start getting a lot revealed about the Vorlons. Like, it pulls up until then,
Now, what I love here, next season, we do see Londo and the Devil talking in the park. Good fact behind the scenes, if you look up behind the scenes of this episode.
Talking in the park.
And that is the song it is playing. It was very distracting while the thing was going on.
They don't listen anything but the music in the park.
Don't let me distract
you, Drake.
We're
getting the experience of watching the show. This is what it felt like.
Take us away, Dre.
All right. So the show was a combination of practical and CGI. So, you know, they would build a set that looked a certain way and then they would CGI in the rest. So they're in this big maze. They're in this big hedge maze that's in Babylon 5, which seems like a real good use of space on a small space station. The first time it aired, the CGI wasn't filled in, and you could actually see the exit sign of the factory they were recording in.
Wow.
And there are still clips of it out there. That's one of my fun behind the scenes. But they're meeting, and we have this fun, again, you're dealing with the Devil, like, Londo, come on, watch a sci-fi episode. We know what's happening. Where he's going,
no,
like,
genre awareness.
Yeah, like, come on, like, don't you know what you're in? Because Morden's like, yeah, I'll take care of it, don't worry. And Londo's like, oh yeah, it's fine, it's easy. And he's go, and you know, later he's gonna be like, I can't believe you did that. And it's like, well, what did you think was gonna happen? So at the same time, or another scene that happens around the same part, is Garibaldi staying on his noir trace. So Stifler has been shot. Who shot Stifler? This random, as Mike and I were saying, I call them theater kids. So in this show, we have this concept of down below. We're a bunch of homeless people that came to Babylon 5 with hopes of a better life. We're going to go somewhere else, couldn't, and are trapped there because of financial
reasons.
It's
a really
Babylon
good difference
5.
Between Star Trek and Babylon 5, that they have the whole down below place, because there's not much of that on Star Trek.
Star Trek just tries to hand wave and say, hey, there's no money in the future. And Babylon 5 is like, yeah, there's money. If you paid to go to Babylon 5 and you couldn't afford transport elsewhere, you're just kind of stuck there. Good idea in concept, and they work on it, but they really overdo the costumes and makeup. So the way I described it to you, Mike, is I said they look like theater people that are just like LARPing.
To be fair, I feel like that's on brand, because like the theater people are probably the people who can't afford to
take
the second trip. It's all actors. It's all actors who couldn't find a gig. They went to Babylon 5 and they said, no, there's no gigs here either.
They're in the Bohemian down below now. Yeah.
I love it. You're adding to it. So it's like they look destitute because they've got their costumes they were going to dress up in, but then they are destitute. That's the only thing I can wear is their costume. I absolutely love it. So Garibaldi like talks to a random guy who's like, I'm going to have, you know, classic television show trope. I'm going to have all the information you need. He was working with this guy. Devereaux is a shady deal, and you'll find him here. I do have to unfortunately be this guy, Mike, the annoying knows too much about Babylon 5 guy.
You're here for. Please do, Dre.
That's what I'm here for. That guy, we find out in a later season, is a runaway telepath who was experimented on and is super powerful. So this random guy with all of the information in future, we're like, you're a telepath. You should have been able to know everything, and this shouldn't have been a problem. But we'll hand wave it.
Well, isn't
it
implied though in the scene that he's like just doesn't want to speak up because he just doesn't want to expose more of the people down below? It's implied that he was also approached by Devereaux, but just didn't want to raise up and you know take the cargo job that Stifler did.
Yeah, it's that fine line where he's like, I don't want any trouble, but I'm just going to give you all the information you need, and it's like, okay, which is it? But we'll accept it for plot.
Here's a little patchwork I'll say that could make it make sense. Is like, you know, if we're talking super powerful telepath, possibly able to see future stuff. I don't know if that's a human trait that they have access to. But if he does, maybe it's like he knows what information needs to get across for the timeline to like go well. And so he's like, okay, I can only say this amount and I can't say this amount. And I can't tell you that I'm a telepath or this, that, the other thing, you know?
All right. We're staying here, Mike. This is too good. So here's the thing. Here's what's great. Human telepaths don't quite have that, but you mentioned other races. The Centauri have like prophecy visions, and the Vorlons have something interesting. And there has been experimentation on human telepaths to be more like Vorlons. I'm loving this. I'm loving the idea that he's a human telepath that was experimented on and actually does have like Doctor Strange abilities, where he's going, I'm sorry, Garibaldi, I know everything. I have to give you this information, because this is what needs to happen for like the humans to succeed long term. And that is actually a premise in the show. Babylon Squared, which you haven't watched, has a lot of the alternate timeline where everything goes wrong and Babylon 5 is destroyed. Evan, you did it. You're starting to seem like a plant for JMS, but it's fine.
I take off my mask, and it was the whole time.
I was like, yeah, I wouldn't even be surprised if you've read Finding Superman, Becoming Superman, his autobiography. I'm like, I'm not even surprised, honestly. Okay.
No, I sadly have no context for anything other than the first and last episode of this.
Could have fooled us. You might as well host the show. Should we start over again?
I also have a theory about Morden and Devereaux, but I don't need to get into that now because
we will stay on that when we get there, but we will do it at the appropriate
time. So this is where Garibaldi finds out about Devereaux, though. That's the whole point of that scene.
So yeah, the super powerful telepath, but like dressed up like a newsie, is like, he's that way guy, and Garibaldi's like, thanks, he's on the case.
Let's get him, coppers.
It's 100% that, but still lots of jumping around. So we get Delenn, who asked Lanier to talk to Kosh. Lanier came back, and then Delenn's like, actually, I'm going to go talk to Kosh. And it's kind of like, man, you're just wasting Lanier's time. She goes to Kosh, and she says, hey, I got to be certain. He opens his suit, and she goes like, cool, I'll
do it. No alien has exposed themselves to me like that before. I'm in.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
That's love.
Continue, Dre.
Yeah. And that by the way, that'll get paid off in season two. So that actually, a lot of the stuff in this episode gets paid off later, which is a credit to JMS, where he's like, I'm going to make the people wait another season, but I will pay it off. So we're fair there. Now we get down to down below, where Garibaldi finds Devereaux, and it is amusing because Garibaldi knows Devereaux is a bad dude, knows he's involved in this shooting, is like, you're coming with me. And Devereaux is literally like, man, this is way over your head. You really should leave this alone. And Garibaldi's like, I'm quaking in my boots. And he sends him to jail. In the comments, don't worry too much about this, Evan, but like Mike and I talk a lot about the hilarious judicial system they tried to put into season one of Babylon 5 that just doesn't work.
Especially in this one where it's like later on, they just walk out of jail.
Yeah. But Mike does note that it's hilarious that Garibaldi is like, you're coming with me. And the henchmen are like, yeah, we're his henchmen. We're coming too.
Yeah, right.
Okay, guess we's yeah. going with you, boss, because you's going to jail. All right.
Yeah. We get back to Londo, who is, and you know, Londo and Veer, if this isn't obvious, it should be. Veer is supposed to clearly be the Jiminy Cricket character to Londo. And mm-hmm. so Londo goes back and is like, I just talked to the devil and he said it's taken care of. And Veer's like, I don't know if you should do this. Is it great? But Londo, you know, it's a lot of the classic, you know, it's hilarious that this was made 30 years ago, but a ton of the Make America Great Again sentiment of Centauri mm-hmm. used to be great. We're not anymore. I want to go back to the old days when we were subjugating mm-hmm. another race. That's in Babylon 5 lore. Mm-hmm. Veer's saying we don't need to do it, but he's saying to do it. Then the next scene, we're going to flip to the other side where Sinclair is going to go visit Jakar and say, yeah, I'm curious to everybody on this podcast how this landed, where Sinclair goes to Jakar and is like, hey, look, I know the Centauri colonized you, but like, you know.
You let them a little bit.
Could you just like move on? Like, can you just move on a little? And I didn't love that.
Yeah, it felt really yeah. kind of out of place for something that he would say, that Sinclair would say, especially after, the episode where by any means necessary, where he was really on the side of labor to the point where he would use like Earth's oppressive government against itself to help out the labor party. Mm-hmm. But this was, yeah, I felt this was really kind of like, I didn't think Sinclair, he always tries to find a diplomatic solution. He's a very Picard type right. character he becomes over the course of the season. I just didn't think he would say that to Jakar.
Yeah, I mean the thoughts I had on that was like it seemed like the humans are focusing so much on like let's just not have there be active conflict right now without the historical context of like, well, this is how we got to where we are right now.
Mm-hmm.
Why is there this conflict? It's like whatever I can do to just defuse it. So if there's a guy with a gun, I'm gonna tell him to not hold the gun, even if his whole family was shot by mm-hmm. another guy. Who's now going, ooh, I don't have a gun. Ooh, you're shooting an unarmed person. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah. It's obviously that's an oversimplification.
That's pretty much it. That pretty much sums up what's going on. Like, yeah, had a gun. The Centauri had a gun. They don't right now. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's accurate.
They're about to get another guy to launch a nuke.
To Sinclair's point, it's like this is right before the proverbial shit hits the fan everywhere for mm-hmm. both, you know, the shadows coming in and for Earth itself with the assassination we're about to get. So it's like, I can see myself feeling that way in retrospective after the rest of the events of this episode would occur. So I can see how he's like really trying to play that diplomatic side ahead of that, talking to Jakar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry. There was no assassination. I'm pretty sure the nuclear core just went off. That's what the lady said. There's no way that anyone would have assassinated a president. That never happens.
Now we get the clearly everything's going to go bad scene because we're at dinner. Sinclair's like, hey, we just got engaged. Garibaldi will be my best man. Catherine, I believe is her first name, is just like, Ivanova, we don't know each other, but will you be my maid of honor because we only have so many actors and we're not paying for someone else. She's like, sure. And they're all like, isn't everything great? And Garibaldi's like, man, stuff's been rough, but isn't it great? And then he's like, you know, funny thing, though, the guy I arrested that said I shouldn't arrest him has a gun that he would only have if he was a Black Ops Earth operative or was given it by a Black Ops Earth operative. Mm-hmm. Boy, is that weird. And then he gets an alert that says, hey, that guy that you just said that about escaped, apparently. Shocker. Who could have seen that coming? And it's like, okay, let's all break and we'll come back to where we were having this happy discussion. The next scene, I'm really, really curious about how this aged, because you said you didn't grow up with the show. So we do actually see the shadows destroy. So we get to the Narn colony and we see mad CGI with the shadow vessels that kind of look like the hair clips and just utterly obliterate this.
I'm not going to be able to see the hair clips now. Thanks.
We get some more world, some awesome stuff. It's really going to get going. Like, actually, it's funny because after that wedding scene, this just really cooks with gas. We briefly get told, hey, the VP is sitting behind, but, and you know, it's told overtly enough that we should be like, that's odd, but it's told quickly enough. And in a way we've been told all season, nothing is odd, just like on a news telecast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because Santiago is going on route to Jupiter. And it's just a newscast, like out of nowhere, almost says like, "Hey, the vice president is sick and won't be joining."
Yeah, they're just like keeping up. They just refueled, and president's off, and vice president's staying behind, and he'll catch up. Yeah, there's too many tangents to go there, so we'll stick on track. Okay, so now we do get Garibaldi doing awesome, where Garibaldi just does an amazing amount of detective work quickly. Mm-hmm. So he's like, hey, Devereaux was shipping all these containers. One couldn't make it because like the ship got quarantined or something. Again, awesome world building from JMS, where that does make sense. It's a space station. Stuff's going to ship out of it. Stuff wouldn't be able to go. And he basically finds a jamming device and a triangulator and very quickly determines someone is going to use this to jam all important signals to something, and then is able to quickly determine, oh no, that's right by where the president's going to go.
And he has Tom Everett Scott sitting next to him saying, oh, I don't know what's going on, playing dumb, like giving all like really eyebrow face. I'm trying to do it on a podcast hard enough so listener can see how hard I'm doing the eyebrow face.
The rough thing about that actor, now clearly this episode, so Mike is talking about a guy that does look just like Tom Everett Scott playing Garibaldi II, who is about to betray him.
He's doing that thing you do.
Yep. Tom Everett Scott wasn't that movie. Anyway, okay, but... obviously, he knows this episode, but he was hired and was on three episodes before this episode and was not told he would betray Garibaldi. Mm. So he just has resting villain face because he's one of the most ominous. Wow. That's got to suck when you're hired and they're like, why did you hire me? It's like, well, you know, because you look really suspicious, like you'd murder someone. And like, oh, cool.
Right.
I'm going to have a lot to deal with. But yeah, so Garibaldi very quickly determines, oh, no, he's going to attempt to assassinate the president, the Devereaux guy that he tracked down. He's like, oh, no. He calls Sinclair and is like, we got to talk. And then, of course, does the wise movie trope thing and then says, I can't tell you, though. Meet me in 5 minutes. And then he gets shot in the back by his second, who has, as Mike put in the notes, if you watch this scene, I assume as you were watching the scene, like, could not clearly be more overt that he's in on. He's like, what's that? Maybe we should leave it alone. I don't, does this really matter? Maybe we should leave. Maybe we should go get a beer. And Garibaldi's like, this is really ominous. And then winds up shooting
him in the back.
Right. When you're really good at picking up clues, but you can't read face signals.
Yeah. Especially when that guy, I mean, he's clearly evil and going to shoot you in the back, dude. No, one thing you said though, that I think that was really good piece of small writing was how Garibaldi had to tell Sinclair, hey, I can't tell you what's going on, but I'll meet you in 20 minutes. And because he said, I can't say it over the comm, because obviously he's, you know, he's assuming that he's being tracked everywhere. So he gives you a very good story reason for why they keep that from the viewer to keep the dramatic tension up to why Sinclair can't find that for a while. In the meantime, he's going to get shot. So I just thought that was a beautiful setup for this.
Yeah, my general take is I've got no complaints with story conventions or tropes as long as you use them effectively. So when you do have someone do that, you know, narrative, oh no, they're putting themselves in danger by saying not now, but later, there better be a good reason why not now, but later. And Garibaldi even says it quickly. He says, I cannot tell you over an open comm. Yeah. Clearly, if these people are using jamming devices, they're tracking communications. So he knows. All right, now we do get the funny payoff. Delenn shows up to Sinclair, says, hey, you know how you keep suspecting me? An episode you probably missed, Evan, way back. There was a point where a random scary Mimbari shows up to Delenn and is like, if he knows, you have to kill him. So there's something going on there, but she comes up and says, you remember me, you remember this triangle thing. Hey, by the way, if you want to know, you have to come right now. I hope nothing else is going on. I'll tell you right now, my schedule just opened up. If you talk to me right now, I got some time. And he goes, Garibaldi's missing. I don't have time. And we keep praising JMS, but a ton of respect for this, where he does set that kind of stuff up well. There's prophecies that are things that are going to happen. And hey, what if people have schedules and lives and it doesn't play out? All right. Now we get a real ramp up to Jakar, which is awesome. So I think this is the last scene, official scene with Natoth, his second as a regular, where she basically says, hey, that station we were bickering about to start the show, it's gone. 10,000, like, essentially warriors are dead. We don't know how. And Jakar is like doing the mental calculus and basically going, no one could have, who could have done this?
Yeah, he just figures out that there's another player out there by doing the mental calculations. Like, it couldn't have been the Minbari. They wouldn't do it. Neither would Earth wouldn't do this. The non-aligned nations, they're no one else is powerful enough. And the Centauri are already right there. It clearly wasn't them.
There are two parts of that. Earlier in the season, Jakar actually saved Sinclair's fiance when she went too close to an old planet with an older race. And he said, hey, there are old races that we don't know anything about. And we just leave them alone. And he is pretty wise. And so this is a good step to that. And that's going to show up in season two. So we get a little bit more of that. But it's, things have escalated between the Narn and the Minbari and Centauri. And Jakar is starting to figure it out. Now, we did have a recurring bit that Mike and I have talked a lot this season with Garibaldi, where he's just this creep in the elevator, which is done. Every time this character named Talia Winters goes in the elevator, she remarks on it, Garibaldi is there and he's acting weird. And so it is funny that the end of the season ends with Garibaldi crawling into the elevator, dying, and the elevator probably just laughing because we assume the elevator has a personality.
Well, it's not an elevator. It's a turbo lift.
Oh, yeah. You got me. You got me. Like,
got to call you out on that.
Nice. Yeah. Nice.
Watch what we do. We put it in episode one, Mike. We pay it off in season four.
Exactly. Plant and payoff, my friend. Chekhov is all over this.
Now, Jinx. Garibaldi crawls out of the elevator. It's a New Year's celebration. Everybody's like, oh, everything's great. He crawls out. He's like, help me. He's getting rushed to sick bay. Sinclair's like, what happens? And he does try and tell him. He's like, they're going to kill the president. You got to go. Sinclair rushes off to try and tell people and can't get through because, as Garibaldi discovered, they found a way to jam all the signals. Sinclair is pretty clever where he says, hey, see if we can reach the news crew. If we can reach the news crew, they might be able to reach him. It's all too late. We see the president's ship explode. In the midst of that happening, this is a weird scene where Delenn says it's time. She completes her magnetiles, which were, they've been building this all season. Hats off to the idea. I don't think the execution quite paid off. And then Lanier is just like watching her get cocooned and crying. And she's like making like noises.
Like, yeah, making painful noises.
It was a weird scene. That's
pour one out. We're old, Delenn.
I'm interested because you can see through the cocoon. So my thought is that this change is mental and not physical. But I don't know if that is, I don't know if I'm reading too much into it because you can like see her eyes. I don't know if she's going to turn into goop when you can see it and she'll just spill out or something.
Yeah, because isn't that what happens inside with the chrysalis, is they all turn to goop when a caterpillar goes in there and it like the goop reforms into the butterfly.
I think
that's all that goes through my head. Yeah.
I was actually looking into caterpillars, and there are certain species of caterpillars where actually they will form their chrysalis. For the love of God, do not take my word for this. Look this up also yourself if you're listening to this.
Evan is a scientist. Don't worry.
I absolutely went to more than 1 year of college, didn't. But there's a certain species of caterpillar that will actually form their chrysalis like underneath their skin. And then when they shed their skin, they shed out into the chrysalis. Now, that's not all species, but that's some of them.
That is
that crazy?
Fly Cronenberg bullshit right there.
The world of insects is horrifying and so cool and interesting.
Wow.
Don't even get me started on praying mantises. For you at home, there's a praying mantis painting behind me.
Yeah, there's like good, great episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer with that, but there's no time. We got to try and save the president, which we can't do. Now we get a fun moment where Sinclair like tries to find Devereaux. He's like, Garibaldi was tracking Devereaux, try and find him. And Tom Everett Scott, I can't unsee it. This is Garibaldi's second in command. We have this great real police moment where He's like, oh no, Devereaux's dead. And another security guy goes, your gun is cold though. Or their guns are cold. If they shot at you, wouldn't their guns have heated up? And then he's like, what are you trying to say? And they go, oh yeah, yeah, the guns cool.
You mean
off.
These so guns?
Yeah. You know, don't do whatever. So, you know, we definitely see that that is a major problem, that mm-hmm. security is entirely compromised. Devereaux is dead. The president is dead. Garibaldi's in a coma. Like, you know, very funny to kind of go this route where, mm-hmm. you know, normal show, he might have been able to save it, but he doesn't.
Yeah.
We have a very interesting scene where there's like a monorail that goes around the station, basically. And Jakar and Natath come in and talk with Ivanova and say, hey, you know, we've had our differences, but your president just died. We just had a base blown up. Something's going on. This isn't great. Hopefully we all get, you know, hopefully we all get recompense. And as Mike noted, this is a case, unfortunately, where the CGI is a 0.5 or whatever math fraction you were bringing up.
This is the one that took me out of it. Then I think I watched this episode like 3 times in the past couple of weeks. Uh-huh. And this is the only one where it's like the old backgrounds when you're driving in the 50s and someone's pretending to drive and there's this film strip projected behind them. Well, they were using the Babylon 5 CGI. Except it looked like the scene went on for a couple minutes and they had about 15 to 20 seconds of loop going on behind them. So this bar comes by behind Jakar as he's really getting on with Ivanova. They're commiserating with each other over losing the president, losing the colony. And in the background, keeps getting hit in the head with this giant like CGI bar every time that it goes past.
I was going to try and I'm not going to try and fix it. It's, you know, that is always the fun. And we were kind of saying that is one of the hard parts of the show for any actor is you don't know how good or bad the CGI is going to be. Mm-hmm. You just have to have faith while you are recording. Hey, it's going to look better. And you have no idea. I will also give the benefit of bigger TVs nowadays than old days. Mm-hmm. You know, my monitor nowadays is, you know, I upgraded to a 25 inch cathode ray tube in college, which was when this show had been off the air for a few years. And that was a big deal to me. And nowadays my computer monitor is bigger. So sometimes I do wonder, you know, that thing where, you know, they make the show, they're like, who's going to care? Most people are watching this on a 20 inch television screen. Mm-hmm. Not knowing in the future we're all going to have like crystal clear high definition.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine watching parts of this on an HD, like one of those hyper definitive one that makes everything look like a British drama, because like it just kept pulling me out of that emotional scene.
All right, now we get back to now gloves are off, so we get back to the garden with Londo and Mr. Morden the Devil, and gloves are off because Londo's like, "What did you do?" Which again is hilarious here because he went, please deal with this military outpost. There aren't many ways he could have dealt with it. So Morden's like, well, what did you think I was going to do?
Right.
Londo goes, well, I didn't think that. And then Morden really gets the gloves off. He's like, who cares? Do you care about them? They're dead Narn. Doesn't matter. We can just, you know, one dead, a million dead, doesn't matter. Londo says something very ominous, which will pay off, where he goes, why don't you just eliminate the entire Narn homeworld while you're at it? And Morden ominously says one thing at a time. And then it's basically like, hey, by the way, everybody in Centauri Prime loves you now, which is something Londo has been wanting. He's been wanting to chase glory.
Right.
He's like, hey, you're getting what you want and you'll owe me a favor. And this is the like temptation of Londo. Season 1 has kind of been that. He has been this kind of wrongheaded person, a buffoon who's kind of wanted glory things that showed up in Signs Importance. It's like, where is he going to go? This season definitely sends him on a path, which is a bummer, but it is also awesome. And of the actors on the show, Mr. Morden, who is Ed Wasser or Wasser, I don't know how you'd say it, depending on, you know, if you're doing German or not. And Peter, they're two amazing actors. So this is just done spectacularly. And I certainly hope there's no silly CGI that's going to take us out of that in the near future.
Uh-oh.
We do get a throwback. This next scene is based off of the assassination of JFK.
Yeah.
Because we have Sinclair and crew watching President Clark being sworn in. And this is literally based off of, I want to say, like old Lyndon Johnson being sworn in after the assassination.
Yeah,
it's literally
I was reading
off.
Some behind the scenes where he was just literally watching how those were staged. Those LBJ talks were staged mm-hmm. right after, and they staged the way that the vice president comes in exactly the same way for the scene.
Wow.
And we do get an immediate turner. You know, that's what I do love is there is some good dialogue that is fine. That if you're not listening carefully, you might not catch it, but it makes sense there. Because as we're hearing the newscast, we do hear Clark say, hey, by the way, Santiago wanted to like open human and alien relationships, but I think we need to focus back home. So he's saying that as he's getting sworn in. And we might not be paying a bunch of attention to that versus, you know, when Garibaldi just tells us everything. So we are getting the like the major shift. Santiago thought this. Clark thinks this. This is now a shift.
Oh, it's a clear nationalism thing that he's like, now we're going nationalism, closing the borders. We don't want this, you know, it's not globalism in there because obviously it's, you know, a whole galaxy. But yeah, that's what they're going for.
Sinclair tries to call a senator and go, hey, this we think there's a problem. And it is sketch as heck how the senator is just like, do not worry about it. Do not look into this at all. Don't look. Don't worry. It's cool. Don't be suspicious. Do not worry. You know, it's the shirt that's like my shirt saying, don't worry, there's clearly nothing wrong with the presidential thing that just happened is like causing more questions than it's answering. Mm-hmm. But that happens. So we do at least get the attempt to say, hey, something's going wrong. Can we talk to Earth and have them investigate? And it's like, oh, that ship has sailed. Whatever has been set in motion with this is gone. The president was clearly targeted in this. Mm-hmm. People are behind the scenes. Security on Babylon 5 is compromised. Senators back home are compromised. Mm-hmm. We're screwed. And I have loved this. Multiple Babylon 5 episodes might have ended this way. Not the Star Trek optimistic ending. They just end with like, and then the heroes lost and it sucked. Right. And you're like,
yeah.
Yep.
No.
Well, I wonder if JMS was trying to put something in there about a lot of science fiction. You'll see like what happens when we do get together, when we get past, you know, all our differences and we get to one globe, one Earth. It's like almost what he's saying is like, okay, once now you're Earth, now it's Earth versus everywhere else. There's just another bigger battle to face. And we're not going to ever reach a point, especially in politics or anything, where we're all going to get along. There is, we're always just going to have to figure out how to get through the next phase as we go. And I think, especially knowing a lot of his background from the Becoming Superman novel, that seems like a lot of the themes he's trying to bring into this.
Okay, I want to fast forward to talk some shadow stuff because I know we had teased that.
I was about to go on a tangent on that, but let's not do that.
Let's get there because that's two scenes for now. So let's get to that. That's the dessert, Mike. So let's get there. Okay, so we do get, this is hilarious. Sinclair goes to the bar, is like, what a day. And I love Kosh. Kosh is such a fascinating character. He's popped up periodically throughout season one. King of the Sucker Punch. Apologies, Mike. I did forget to mention that we do have one sucker punch this episode, which is Garibaldi's second shooting him in the back. This has been a recurring theme that Mike noted early on where JMS, if he needed to move plot along, would have one character just randomly attack another character. But as the season has progressed and matured, we have died down. But we do arguably get two this episode with the shadows sucker punching the Narn. And Garibaldi second in command, sucker punch.
They're both, and I will say, I sometimes contend with you on what counts as a sucker punch. I did not count either of those in my official sucker punch count that you can go to MikeSlater.com.
What are you doing, Mike?
You can go to MikeSlater.com right now and get my full definition on what exactly makes a sucker punch and why. I only didn't count these just because the whole reason of the sucker punch is for the world building things. And we're kind of past that now. These aren't sucker punches that are meant to like be cheap sucker punches like the other one. This is a full-on plot, meaningful sucker punch from the soul. So I think we're moving on to a different level of Babylon 5. We go from season one to season two. The sucker punches, along with everything else, are going to become more emotional.
I have a clarifying question about sucker punches.
Oh, please do.
Is it inherent to your concept of that it has to be like out of left field?
Oh yes, it's clearly like one of the main things, like out of nowhere it has to come.
Okay, because I would argue that both of those scenes were set up pretty comfortably, because like the getting shot in the back, it was like, well, he's been threatened actively by that underground guy, and mm-hmm. also this guy is clearly a double agent. So it's I don't think it's that much of a leap.
I highly agree with you, and Dre. Yeah, you should. I see the Evans on my side on this.
You can see because that's the point is. If this entire episode we have been fed, Garibaldi is this master detective who's picking, he is literally piecing together everything, and there is a person next to him that is clearly ominous, and dang.
Okay. I think he just doesn't know how to pick up on social cues. That's why he keeps hitting on people in the elevator. He's like, oh, they're here because they want to see me.
Oh, it's like he hits on right after he's holding his pits in his hands. He's like, he's going to smell them too. This is not somebody who is like socially good around things.
And then for the shadow thing where they destroyed the base, I mean, they said they were going to do it before they did it, right? Like,
they told us. I mean, they told the viewer and they told Londo, right?
Yeah, but does that count as coming out of nowhere?
And then I guess to your point, the Narn knew what they were like. The Narn were being aggressive. Like the Narn were probably expecting a response they just weren't expecting. So I guess by all fronts, like it wasn't a surprise attack. It was just a surprise amount, which to Mike's point is not a sucker punch is one they don't see coming. This is a case where they're like, we see the punch coming. They're like, oh, we were expecting a knife and it's a gun. So
right. Well, sucker punch is like meta, right? Like it's not like the characters getting sucker punched. It's like the audience is. Am I correct in saying that?
You are correct. Because, no, there's three different ways of sucker punch.
Oh, okay, like, cool.
It can be a surprise from the person doing the punching. It can be a surprise to the person getting punched, or it can be a surprise just to the audience that it wasn't set up enough for us.
So these are diegetic sucker punches, but not like meta sucker punches.
Exactly. You get it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sick. Cool.
Sucker punches from the soul. Diegetic sucker punches, the evolution of sucker punches. I love. I will agree, unfortunately, though, that to everybody's point, both of these do not qualify for any of them. The person should have seen the punch coming. If they didn't, it's out of character for them. The audience saw it coming. It wasn't used as a cheap cop out for the plot. So
I think in the end, this is more of a genocidal sucker punch. So I really didn't really feel as happy putting it on the funny sucker punch list.
So shouting out once again, MikeSlater.com. Go there. There are articles on Babylon 5. And Mike, I've been waiting till the end of us recording season one. I am so looking forward to reading your sucker punch article and possibly doing like response content over at patreon.com/Jeff May, the like umbrella thing that we do this under, or at like a YouTube station. So keep your eyes peeled for that. All right. We do get Sinclair at the bar. What a day. And then Kosh, as I mentioned, we were talking sucker punch, just beautiful, pops up and he's so playful. He's very much a Gandalf character because Kosh has done all sorts of things. He kind of shows up. He's just like, and so it begins, which is a wonderful line that's used later in some great soundtracks. And then he's just like, hey, so you forgetting anything? It's just like so hilariously playful to have them both do that ominous voice. And then this next would be like, aren't you forget? I think he says like, you're forgetting something or aren't you forgetting something?
It's the gap.
So he runs, Sinclair runs to see Delenn and it's too late. She's already in the chrysalis. She is transforming, I think is what Lanier says. Jakar leaves a note that was hilarious to Natoth, where he's just like, by the time you see this message, I'll be gone. And he's going to go investigate to see what the heck is going on and saying, you know, I hope everything's okay. And again, this episode 100% ends with Londo and Jakar very much going in different directions.
Yeah,
we do get and now let's see, this is dessert I've been waiting for all episodes. Evan, I really hope you do not disappoint here. The scene is not good, which bums me out, but is hilarious because it's Mr. Morden sitting in a chair in a hotel room. There's an easy joke to make about that chair, but man, there's not time. And he's talking to the shadows. Like you can see like the warble effect. So the shadows are next to him, which is, we know at this point they're shadows. And he's just like, yes, we can, he's going to be ours now. We're fine. We got him. Mm-hmm. And he's like, no, we're fine. And then you hear this like clacking noise that the shadows are making. That's been done by him in this season before earlier, like when he's walking, he'll kind of talk to someone we don't see and that works. Mm-hmm. This scene did just, am I wrong? Tell me if I'm wrong. But when I watched it, I was just like cracking up and like,
it didn't bother me as much as it appeared to bother you. But yeah, it felt a little out of place. It's like, all right, I just don't think it was that necessary. Like we knew everything that was going on. We know that Morden is working with the hair clip guys who came out and destroyed the colony. I don't think we needed that extra push. It only served to like kind of take us out of the scene.
Yeah, I didn't find it offensive. I mean,
I didn't find it offensive. It just wasn't great.
I don't mean offensive in terms of maybe that was not the best word to use.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it offensive. Yeah,
I didn't find it like I didn't feel like I was getting hit in the head with a truck. That's a bad thing. You know, it was like it was fine. I agree that I don't know if it was like necessarily needed. But I didn't feel like it super took me out and like was some ridiculous, super overly ridiculous thing. I don't know. I mean, it's like, you know, I feel like if you're in season one, you might not, like, I don't know how much trust you have in your audience yet, you know, like, I think you're still feeling things out. I don't know what, I don't have a larger context for any of this, which is probably part of why it didn't affect me as much. Cause it's like, I don't know what's coming next. I don't know what came before. You know, but I do get what you're saying about it. There was very clearly, obviously, a connection between those two. You know, but it did, you know what? If there is anything, it's Morden is the, yes, Morden seemed to, and correct me if I'm wrong, but he seemed to have more of like a, almost like an authority role with the shadows, or did he seem to be like reporting to them? What was your guys' interpretation of like their relationship between those two entities?
Yeah, that was more anything that didn't make sense too, because he is a human that is kind of representing the shadows, but at times it almost feels like he's kind of telling them to back off or go this way. Like he has more authority than he should, when really he should just be like their thrall.
Right.
I will say this. They don't explain as much about the shadows and the Vorlons, which makes sense. They're kind of mysterious. Mm-hmm. What we do kind of learn, so I'll give minor spoilers, but this does kind of give it away.
Sure.
About Morden. Morden was a human. So Morden was a human that was on a spacecraft that went and was investigating shadow ruins. And he came out and he is a liaison with the shadows.
Okay.
He is not a human anymore. He is in some way possessed by some shadow entity. Mm. We don't know, you know, because they're like bug creatures, right? We're sticking on the bug theme. He has got like two shadowy bug creatures he's talking to. We don't know the pecking order. So
right.
I think... the reality is, I think he is a liaison to the shadows. The people he is bossing around, or the shadows he's bossing around, we don't know where they are in the pecking order.
Yeah.
And in fact, I'm not sure on world building. People can correct me. I might be wrong, or JMS may have answered. But like, we also don't necessarily know shadow-wise how all of the people in their employ work, right? Because they can clearly like mentally enslave or replace humans. Mm-hmm. So those bug creatures may not even be like shadows legit. They could just be like cloaking dogs that are on the shadow planet. Mm-hmm. So I agree that like he was more of a authoritative role to those, but he clearly answers to someone else and we don't know what just yet.
So if there was anything that scene added, I would think it was the dynamic there. Yeah.
Was there anything, because you had said you had maybe other shadow tangents. This is the place for it. If there's anything
perfect.
Else.
I do have a little theory. So I'm a fan of a manga called Berserk. And so what I'm going to say comes a little bit from that. But my thought is that, okay, so when we went to the underground, there was that one person that said, oh, like, no one comes here unless you're trying to, like, hire one of us, and then no one cares about our lives until, you know, we're needed for something. Mm-hmm. So my theory is that, I'm forgetting, what's the second in command who shot the guy in the back? What's his name?
I don't remember his name because...
Tom Everett Scott.
Tom, I'll call him, great, Tom. My theory is that...
And now, Everett.
Morden... is over Tom in a pecking order, and Morden got Tom to like get Devereaux in on all of this to fulfill a task, has them complete that task, and then kills them so that there aren't any loose ends that they can like tell other people about this or like become a problem later on.
You were really tying together the two separate stories even more than they were, because
I saw them as
completely different stories, because wasn't that all from like the Earth Force Black Ops stuff was where Tom Everett Scott and Devereaux were coming from, and then the shadows were completely different. Am I wrong about that, Dre? Or were those?
So
really
I'm
going to
give a Mike, future Mike, if you want, I'm going to give a spoiler warning. You could use that sound verbatim. Now, Evan, are you down for a spoiler warning?
Hit me with it.
Okay, so this is awesome. Okay, first off. Mike, you know how to pick guests. You have picked some fantastic guests so far. And I'm still like, look, Evan, I'm not convinced you are not tied to JMS somehow. I'm just throwing that out there. Okay, though. Now, check this out. In a later season, they use the machine at Epsilon 3 to get a recording of a meeting between President Clark and someone plotting the assassination of President Santiago. Mm. And that voice is clearly Mr. Morden.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that Mr. Morden is not only visiting to deal with Londo and get the things in motion for that, but is also wrapping up the President Clark to President Santiago assassination coronation doesn't just 100% track, is in universe. So you watching this episode and saying, yeah, we see Morden doing this, but I think he's also doing this. That actually happens and is paid off. So that's an A+. Yeah. And another thing that when I was reading up on like this episode, Mike, JMS said that earlier in the season, there was a rebirth ceremony where Delenn was like taking a berry and saying she was having a rebirth and a marriage. And they made a joke about Londo and Jakar getting married. And he said, I knew everybody was going to focus on the marriage part as the ha-ha joke and not think about the rebirth because Delenn's going to be reborn at the end of the season.
Right.
So A+ work, that theory doesn't just track. I think it's in universe. So
hell yeah.
A+.
Cool. Thank you. That's you know, it's funny. Like, I feel like in a lot of modern media, there's this push to be super subversive and to make it so that no one can like tell where it's going. And like, I think that the lowest version of that is like the Game of Thrones thing where it's like, let's just make it different, but it doesn't track. I think that like a part of a sign of a great story is when you can kind of like see the direction of it early on, if you're really paying attention, you know? I don't see that as I don't see something being, predictable is the wrong word, but like,
well, no, it's in
things
on the joke.
Leading. Yeah. Things leading.
It's not just you're watching. It's like, oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah.
You don't
I think
know
that's a
totally.
Sign of a well crafted narrative. You know?
Totally. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think the key thing, and JMS would agree with this, is like, if you are a viewer, if you are rewarded for paying attention, that is good. That is a good author, viewer, creator, you know, content consumer relationship.
Well, it's like when you're improvising and doing jazz, what do you rely on a lot? It's call and response and motifs. And if you can put a motif somewhere in the audience's mind somewhere, get them used to that, do something else, bring it back in different ways, they'll respond to it differently. It's same thing in comedy with callbacks, you know, when's too late to call something back, as you want to make sure that the audience remembers that and they can come back to it later. So I think that's exactly what, you know, JMS is doing expertly in this meeting.
As an FYI, Mike, I hope I'm not setting the bar too high for you, but I am really hoping for something fun for the spoiler alert warning, because we're going to be able to use that a lot more in seasons 2 and 3.
Yeah, oh, hit up the Metropole Orchestra, get them to do a little jingle.
Ooh, I'll have to ring them up.
It'll probably only cost you a cool $200,000 or.
What don't they owe you?
Yeah, what's
they
budget,
owe you a
Trey?
Favor,
what's,
right?
What's our budget for this thing? $200,000
Yeah.
We got to.
Yeah, right. Something like that. I have no concept of how expensive it is to hire the Metropole Orchestra. It's definitely not chill.
All right. Well, okay. We've gotten through the episode. We've done most. So I was going to say, Mike, anything specific to wrap? Like, I know, of course, we've got the like, what should we be checking out thing, Wasp, but is there anything else we want to end on after?
No, I mean, I'm just excited because I'm taking my 9-year-old son to see his first concert tomorrow night. Can either of you guess who the person we're going to be going to see for a 9-year-old's first concert?
You told me already.
Kendrick
it's
Lamar.
Good, though.
Yeah, that's good. Weird Al Yankovic.
Oh, wait, I knew that. I was there. Oh, I was literally told that you guys were going to see Weird Al.
Yeah, I'm so happy because it's both of my kids. My 14-year-old, her first concert was also Weird Al. My wife and I, we almost met each other at the same Weird Al concert we found out we were at like before we had even met.
Wow.
So,
Evan, fantastic guest. Exceeded.
Thank you.
I mean, I'll be interested on like the comic art, and because I mean, of course, JMS did the same thing. So, yeah.
Yeah, and we definitely want to have you back on, especially because this isn't going to be a Babylon 5 podcast the whole time. I'm definitely have a couple of graphic novels I'm considering for future seasons. So, yeah, we'll definitely want to have you on to talk again.
Hit me up anytime. This was such a blast.
Yeah, so really in the meantime, I mean, this is, you got to check this out. Is there anything, Evan, that you think that the listeners got to check out?
Oh man, like in the world or like from me?
In the world, from
your call.
Like,
anything
this is
you
your
want.
Call. Let's start in with the world. World. Let's throw some plugs in to something world. Else. What do you think users should check out? Is there
oh
like
my god,
you're a graphic novelist, you're a jazzer.
Yeah.
Come
yeah,
on,
yeah,
what should
yeah,
people look
yeah.
at?
Okay, so here's a shout out. They don't need it because they're famous, but I'll say it anyway. I don't know if you've heard of Chainsaw Man. It's a very very famous manga. But the mangaka came out with a series of one shots before Chainsaw Man. That were compiled into these anthologies, and they have such an interesting mind, and I really enjoy all their little super short stories. It's a Fujimoto. I can't remember the first name. Fujimoto. I think that's mm-hmm. the last name.
And that's the same. Is it? Yeah. Is a writer slash author does
yeah,
all.
Yeah,
them,
yeah, yeah. Does the illustration and the writing.
Hatsuki
it's so
Fujimoto,
funny.
And I just yes. looking that up on Wikipedia. So.
Yes, because cool. like it's what it's so, and you get these like really fun little author notes in between every one shot, and they're all basically kind of like talking shit to the editor in a very funny way. Like, there's one story that's just like pretty weird. All of his stories are super weird and off the wall, but he gives us a weird story, and at the end, it's like, my editor told me I couldn't write a normal story, so I wrote this, still not sure if I can do it or not.
Oh, like the old John Byrne She-Hulk stuff he was doing with that, all the meta stuff early mm-hmm. on.
Yeah, yep. So that's, you know, that's fun. I don't know, I always recommend watching and or reading the manga slash anime Hunter x Hunter. It was so good it made me drop out of college. And if there's one thing you're gonna read that I say, it would be Vagabond by Inoue. I don't remember the other name, but it is a adaptation of an adaptation of a philosophy slash fighting strategy book written by a famous samurai back in the Warring States period mm-hmm. In Japan. And the manga is essentially, it takes all the metaphorical concepts from the original text and uses a historical fiction retelling of this samurai's life in order to express these philosophical concepts. If I'm ever feeling lost in life or like I, you know, need to find a center, I just read it. Feels like meditating. It's a beautiful story.
Now that's an awesome take, but I'm obviously at the Wikipedia and I just want to bring this out. So I hope I get the name right. It's Takahiko Inoue.
Yeah.
Most well known though for the basketball series, right? Slam yeah. Dunk. And I mean, you know me, Mike, like Vagabond sounds great, but I mean, Slam Dunk sounds.
That's what's great about getting recommendations. Like, you can take the recommendation well, and you can find out, oh, there's something else I've always wanted to get into.
I'll go one step further than that. If you think that sounds interesting, he also has another manga called Real, and it's about wheelchair basketball. So right, that's so, something you're interested
again,
in.
Again, yeah. you recommended the non-basketball one. I'm just known. Like, you know, there's a lot of
yeah.
basketball
oh,
there,
yeah.
too.
Oh, yeah.
No, we'll get those all put in the notes, too, because, yeah, I'll definitely want to check. I've been meaning to get into Chainsaw Man for quite some time, and now
it's
that I know that there's an
story.
Anthology. Yeah. Like, I love anthology books, just being mm-hmm. able to go from one story
I'll
to the
give
next.
You the – I have the physical copies. I'll lend them to you.
Yes.
You can borrow.
And is there anything personal that you want to plug that people should check out of yours? I know you're still like building up towards
yeah.
the big graphic novel.
In 3 years, check out my graphic novel, Journey to Curio City. But before then, I've got a YouTube channel, Evan X Evan. That's EVYNNEX, same spelling. That's like I make YouTube video essays sometimes here and there. You know.
Cool. we'll get that up and put that in the show notes. So I'll link to that. So hopefully get some viewers there.
Wonderful.
Love it. Thank you. I'm of course trying to multitask and look up all the cool stuff to check out. Slam Dunk does look fascinating to me.
Oh yeah.
All right, well, thank you. I mean, Mike's plugged ahead of time. Thank you so much for being on.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah,
well,
great.
Yeah, we'll love more in the future. More Babylon 5 is fine too if you feel like watching season 2 or season 3.
Oh yeah, hit me up for any of it. I'm down.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we're still booking some guests. We're not going to have like the same ones on a few times in a row, but I think we're going to run out of guests before too long. So yeah, I will definitely be hitting you up again, Evan. This was
cool.
Great.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for being on.
Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. We come to the end of season 1. Everybody's still alive, though. So, you know, maybe someone does need to sucker punch Mike to end this season of You've Got to Check This Out. Head over to patreon.com/JeffMay, which was the genesis where this originally started. Thanks, everybody, for listening. That brings us to a wrap on season 1 of You've Got to Check This Out, Babylon 5, season 1. You will be shocked to discover that season 2 of You've Got to Check This Out is coming at you fast, and it is Babylon 5, season 2.
Yes.
Don't worry, at some point we will do something else, but as an FYI, there are 5 seasons of Babylon 5, and I am already arguing with Mike that 3 to 4 episodes is not enough per season. So for the foreseeable future, this is a Babylon 5 podcast, but we have already started dreaming of more. And if you want to help support that, patreon.com/Jeff May and MikeSlater.com. Those are going to be your two best bets to just kind of keep appraised of everything going on. I would, of course, say MikeSlater.com will be the primary one. And go tell Mike why he's wrong on some of his suckabouts. It's not all of them.
Oh, yeah. I'm on Blue Sky. You can hit up Slatron at Blue Sky.
And I am a nerd number. So feel free to tag Mike about why he's wrong and tag me as well. Or you can also tag me to tell me I look like a bunny, something Mike actually did do on Blue Sky.
Mm-hmm. He does sometimes. All right. Well, yeah. Thanks a lot, Evan, for being here. We had a great time.
Thank you, guys. It was such a pleasure.
And we'll see you all next season, where possibly Mike will just be replaced by Bruce Boxleitner, if I can get him. I'm trying to book him.
Oh, I would do it. I wouldn't blame you.
Oh, I did skip over one scene. So let's pretend we missed a scene, but let's pretend, Mike, we can just edit and just pretend that it was fine.
This is all
and it happens
in,
after
baby.
Morton and Lund.
Hey, editor. Yeah, keep this in.
Keep it in. Double it.